Good morning. I hope your day is going well. I wanted to start off by thanking those of you that presented yesterday. I sure saw some awesome presentations, being a veterinarian, Down syndrome, space garbage, venom versus poison, winemaking. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's pretty cool. Still kind of buzzing with all those ideas, to be honest, man. If you present today, I'm looking forward to your presentations, too. That's going to be totally cool. These take a while to grade, so bear with me while I go through that stuff, because it's really fascinating stuff. But definitely looking forward to the ones today, and thank you for those of you that did present yesterday. Very, very cool. We're going to continue on talking about how to predict if reactions occur or don't occur. And in the world of science, this is kind of a big thing, because it would be nice to know if you have a reaction which was more product favored, which basically means it will occur, or more reactant favored, which means it doesn't really occur very much. And when Boltzmann here in the corner and all the other scientists looked at all the reactions known, they came up with a conclusion that almost all product favored reactions had a type of dispersal. And dispersal can be in form of energy, so energy going from a very concentrated form to a less concentrated form. It can be in terms of matter, going from a very concentrated matter form to a very dispersed matter, or both energy and matter. I see Melissa's donuts here. I'm going to pick on her a little bit. No, you're totally fine. Don't choke on it or anything. But anyway, Melissa's eating a very luscious-looking donut there. Homer Simpson to me. Anyway, that is essentially a source of concentrated energy she's eating right there, because the energy from the donut will go through her body. The matter, which is condensed as you eat something, will be distributed through. That's a good example of a reaction which will occur. All right. If you have a caffeine drink, same idea. All right. It will also go through your body and happen. It's less likely that a reaction will occur where the energy or the matter is dispersed and it becomes more concentrated. All right, and that's kind of what they're saying right here. And that's kind of interesting to think about, not only as a scientist, but philosophically, as the types of reactions which will go and which ones won't go.
Consider a pair of flasks, one containing gas molecules, the other completely empty. If the flasks are connected at their mouths, gas in the filled flask will move spontaneously to the empty flask by its molecular motions. Eventually, the distribution of molecules will be even throughout the flasks. The final state in which the matter is more dispersed is much more probable than the initial undispersed state.
So in this case, we have a vacuum on the right and some kind of gas, nitrogen, whatever, on the left. And if you open the stopcock, it's not unbelievable to think that the gas would move from the left to the right. But it wouldn't be like all from the left to the right. At the end, there would be like an equal distribution. So imagine you had like one mole here. At the end, you might have about half of a mole on both sides, something like that. That's an example of matter dispersal, where a concentrated source of matter is distributed over a larger volume, if you will, to a larger area. We did this example on Monday, but let's do it again just because it's silly and fun. If you're thinking about matter dispersal, again, the punchline here is that you want it to go from a concentrated source to a less concentrated source, all right? So cleaning your room, there's probably junk all over your room, and you kind of put everything together. That wouldn't be matter dispersal. That would be concentrating the matter. So if you had all this junk and you put it all in your drawers, it's now in a more concentrated form than it was before. So that wouldn't be a good one. Here's obviously a more chemical example. If you take gaseous water and you condense it, you're going to probably condense it down to a liquid. So what took up a lot of volume before is now in much less volume. That is not matter dispersal. That's antimatter dispersal. Crystallization is a term that's used when you make a solid from a solution, and in organic chemistry you'll do more than that. But the key part here is that you're going from to a solid from a solution, from some kind of an aqueous thing probably. That's not constant. That's that's concentrating the matter. That's not dispersing the matter out. That wouldn't be right. And this last one down here, if you form ammonium dichromate from all these things, there's a lot of moles that go into here. And so a lot of moles to one mole is also not a matter dispersal. You're concentrating essentially all of these moles into ammonium dichromate. That's not matter dispersal either. But just like I was saying with Melissa eating a donut earlier or anything, if you eat something, you are going from a concentrated matter source to a less concentrated. All right. If you are with friends and you pass the food around, all right, you're distributing it that way. It goes into our bodies and distributed and stuff like that. So this is kind of silly, but it is important to recognize that this is a type of reaction which does occur. All right. And when you look at all the reactions, almost all of them have either this form, matter dispersal, or the next form, energy dispersal. Any questions? So the other kind is energy dispersal.
Stored chemical potential energy is released from reactant molecules in an exothermic reaction. This energy spreads out or disperses over the product molecules and the molecules in the surroundings.
In my science world, this little dot in the middle would be the quote-unquote system, and the outside molecules, we'll say they're water molecules, would be like the surroundings, the outside. So if you had, for example, a piece of sodium metal reacting with water, a lot of energy is released. And the energy, which was a potential energy essentially in the sodium before, is distributed to a larger amount of molecule. So this is an example of energy dispersal. All right. If you start a fire in your fireplace, that would be energy dispersal. The energy is going from the wood to warm you up. If you take your car and you drive to school, the energy comes from the gasoline, which is essentially doing this kind of thing in the pistons. So this is the other example of dispersal. It's an energy dispersal. And again, some things have both energy and mass dispersal. Some of them are one or the other. Now, exothermic reactions, all right, which is a term we talked about on Monday, but I want to do it again. Exothermic refers to enthalpy, and enthalpy's values, which are negative, are called exothermic, and that really is energy dispersal, all right, energy is going out into the universe. And so exothermic reactions happen because the potential energy in a piece of sodium or a piece of wood, if you're going to burn it, or gasoline or whatever, that potential energy is released essentially as a type of kinetic energy. So the energy is distributed, it's dispersed to a larger medium. That potential energy starts in a smaller amount of molecules and is distributed over a lot larger number of molecules. And it might be the water, if it's a solvent. It might be the air, if you're burning a fire and stuff. It'll be whatever is around it and stuff. Some way that energy is going to be distributed. We can't create or destroy energy. Please remember that too. So it's going to be distributed somewhere. We may not always know exactly where it's going to go, but it's not going to just disappear into the nether. The final state with the energy dispersed in an exothermic reaction is more probable. All right? And usually reactions are product favored. So this part right here is really stemming what we've done up to this chapter. We assume that if the reaction was exothermic, and because of that basically energy dispersal, that those are the ones which are going to occur. Those are the product favored reactions. Those are the reactions which we would say those are going to go, all right? But you can see there I have a usually. And the reason why this chapter is so important is that although most of the time exothermic reactions indicate a reaction which is going to happen, you can probably imagine that by this little part right there, it's not all the time. So that's what we'll explore this morning and see what's going on exactly. Exothermic reactions are fun. They have lots of energy released and stuff. It might be as simple as just caffeine in your bloodstream, or it could be this thermite reaction, which is really fun. There's no sound, I don't think, with this video. This is an example of a reaction. It's iron 3 oxide reacting with aluminum. It makes pure iron and aluminum carbon monoxide. This delta H here is very negative. It's very exothermic. So that means you're going to have a lot of energy coming off. And you can see in this video, man, they have like super protective shields because there's so much energy released. Sometimes it makes little kind of cool sparks and stuff. At the end, you do in theory have pure iron. Anyway, it's a fun reaction. It's very exothermic. We mixed them together. Something happened. Woohoo! Exciting! And most of chemistry so far has been like this kind. However, just because something happens, it doesn't have to have a big kabam, all right, with it, all right? And that's what this next video is gonna see. Now, this next video is not as exciting as things like thermite, but it is something that does occur. And I want you to think about what the differences are between this very exothermic reaction and the next reaction.
In the center beaker is water at room temperature. To this we add solid ammonium nitrate. The ammonium nitrate dissolves. Usually, a reaction that occurs so readily is exothermic, but we see from the thermometer that this reaction is endothermic. The temperature of the water drops significantly. This reaction is not favored energetically, yet it still occurs.
Now, this reaction, we're taking ammonium nitrate, placing it in water, and it dissolves. Whoopee-doo, right? No explosions, no cool colors or anything like that. And you're like, man, Russell, you need to get better cough medicine. But why this is exciting for us, all right, is that this is a reaction where something happened, all right? Now, oh boy, ammonium nitrate dissolving in water, but that is something that happens, okay? And the something that happens here is different from the last example because it's endothermic. Now, up to this chapter, all of 221, 222, and most of 223, all right, we would have said that an endothermic reaction probably not going to happen. But this is an example of a reaction which is endothermic, and it's happening. It's spontaneous, which was a term we talked about on Monday. Spontaneous just means that the reaction will go. So this is kind of an anomaly based on the things we've talked about so far. We've been using just delta H to tell if a reaction's going to occur, which is spontaneous, or if it's not going to occur, non-spontaneous. This reaction is spontaneous. It is occurring, but it is not exothermic. This is endothermic. You could see the temperature go down as this happened. So what we're starting here is a discussion as to really what makes a reaction spontaneous or non-spontaneous. What makes the reaction go or not go? And it's more than just enthalpy, all right? Usually, exothermic reactions do imply a reaction which is spontaneous that'll happen. But as you can tell from this one, it's a little bit deeper than that. So the other piece that's needed is something I started to talk about on Monday, which is entropy. And entropy is really fascinating. As a scientist, as a person, philosophy, all these kind of things will totally come together when it comes to entropy. So again, when scientists look at all the reactions and stuff, there is definitely a tendency for reactions to become more disordered, more messy, all right? And on Monday, I did lots of examples. Oh, it's even still here. Oh, I've got all my papers. Oh, they're nicely organized. Oh, I drop them. Now they're not as nice, all right? They're more distributed, all right? So it wasn't naturally things don't become more ordered. Naturally, things become more disordered. And this is really the crux of what entropy is. It's a measure of disorder. It's a measure of messiness. And if you're a person that has a messy room or a messy car or whatever, oh, you're just following the laws of thermodynamics, my friends, because that's really what entropy is all about. It's just as important, really, as enthalpy when it comes to figuring out if reactions will occur. So entropy, all right, which is given the symbol S, all right, entropy is nothing more than a measure of disorder, all right? And there's a tendency for things to go from a more ordered state to a less ordered state. And that's what entropy is all about. Now, just like enthalpy is a measure of energy released, and there's a lot of reactions where energy is released exothermic, but there are also reactions where the energy is absorbed endothermic, we're going to see that with entropy, there are reactions which are becoming more disordered, more messy, but there's also reactions which will become less disordered, more organized, if you will. It's the same kind of phenomenon, just with a different kind of a term here. Entropy is something that's been dancing behind us all the time, and now it's exposed as the player for chemical reactions that we see it actually is. Any questions on this weird thing? All right, so entropy can be expressed by many different ways, and this isn't something we're going to do a lot with, but earlier on Boltzmann's gravestone, believe it or not, he wanted S equals K natural log of W placed on it. Now, I love science, and if I discovered a law, maybe I would think different. However, I don't know if that's what I'd want on my gravestone, but anyway, Boltzmann was pleased by it, so more power to him. Anyway, what Boltzmann and these other people did is he realized that S equals K natural log of W. Now, S is the entropy. W is what they call the microstates. And again, we're not going to go real heavy into this version of entropy, but I do want to introduce it here. K is called the Boltzmann constant, and this is not something you have to memorize. But what people do when they get into entropy big time is they figure out how many of these microstates there are. And if there are fewer, there are lower entropy. And if there are more microstates, it's higher energy. All right? So imagine I'm a robot for a second, all right, and I'm a robot, and I can only go up, medium, and down. That would be like three microstates. But as a human being, I can dance and move around, all right? As a human being, I would have more microstates and more entropy. As a robot, I would have fewer microstates and less entropy is how you think about it. All spontaneous endothermic processes exhibit an increase in entropy. So we're going to see that ammonium nitrate dissolving in water example, which you all went, woohoo, whoa, it dissolves in water, cool. Anyway, we are going to see that means it's got an increase in entropy. It's going to have more of these microstates than the other one. So here's an example of an atom looking at different things and stuff. And there's lots of things like this you can get in. Here's what I want you to look at right there. The more atoms you have, the more entropy you can have. All right, because you can have more of these microstates happen. Here's A, B, and C, three atoms. Here's two atoms and one atom. And you can imagine that there's only one atom. It could be on the left and the right. There would be two microstates. But here's like it. See, if you have two atoms, et cetera, et cetera. Just realize that as atom systems get more complex, they have more entropy. So if you look at something like sodium chloride with two atoms, that would be two atoms worth of entropy. If you compare that to like our DNA with thousands of atoms, oh man, there's going to be a lot more entropy. So the more atoms you have in a chemical system, the more entropy you're going to have. And that's the only thing I want you to pull from these last two slides. Don't worry about the Boltzmann constant. Don't worry about the microstates. Just realize that the more atoms you have, the more entropy you're going to have too. Okay.
Molecular motions are much more random in the gas state than in either the liquid or solid states. Motion in a liquid is more random than that of a solid. Gases tend to have the highest entropies, while solids have the lowest.
So just like in my silly robot example earlier, all right, robot had only three states. It was pretty, didn't have a lot of entropy compared to me, who sometimes thinks he's a hippie. Sorry, I shouldn't make myself laugh. School is getting better, I promise you. Yes, Silas, I am. I promise I'll be there. That's right. Prophet on. All right. Solids, much more rigid than liquids. Liquids, much more free than gases. All right, that's the end of my hand waving, I think, Your Honor. Anyway, so notice the values which people can calculate. The solid has a lower number, this is a value for entropy, than liquid, and liquids are lower than gases. And this is a trend across the board, all right? And these numbers just reflect that there's less of those microstates that we talked about earlier than the liquids, and liquids have less microstates than gases. The punchline is that solids will always have a smaller entropy than liquids, and liquids will always have a smaller entropy than the gases that they come from. Now, here's the third law of thermodynamics. And again, you can ignore this math part, but the only pure elements in perfectly formed crystals at zero Kelvin have zero entropy. All right. So the only time you're going to have an entropy value of zero is for a pure element in a perfect crystal at zero Kelvin. How likely do you think that is to happen? Nada. Right. It ain't going to happen. We haven't even gotten down to zero Kelvin arguably yet. So yeah, that's like almost an impossibility. So from the third law, all right, we can pull a couple of things. First of all, is that entropy will never be zero, and we're going to see that an entropy value of a compound won't be negative either. These entropy values of compounds are usually positive numbers, and the only time you can get to zero is this very rare, pure element, perfect crystal, zero Kelvin, never going to happen kind of comment, all right? All right. So which of these do you think will have the highest entropy at 25 degrees Celsius? We're going to see there's a temperature dependence on these things. So you can see here there's five choices. First of all, unobtainium is a funny thing from science fiction. It's not a real element and stuff. If you see the Avatar movie, it always cracks me up. Anyway, we have here a solid, two liquids, and a gas. Which one of those has the most freedom to move around / microstates? Gas, that's right. The gas is going to be the one with the highest one. All right. Gases are almost always a lot more than the liquids or the solids that they come from. All right. Any questions on that? Here's just some more examples. Here's bromine. Bromine is a compound which does exist in the liquid phase at room temperature, but there's a pretty good gas phase over it. You would again say, excuse me, that the liquid is less than the gas. Here's ice versus liquid water, like an iceberg and stuff. Again, the solids will have less entropy than the liquids. The little superscript right there is for standard states. We talked about this a little bit with delta H. If you have a standard state thermodynamic value, you give it that little zero, the degree symbol. It means like one atmosphere of pressure, usually 25 degrees Celsius, stuff like that. Excuse me.
Heptane at 1500 Kelvin has significantly greater molecular motion than it does at 200 Kelvin. The substance has greater entropy at 1500 Kelvin than at 200 Kelvin.
Temperatures definitely affect the entropy of things. You can imagine if this is a cold day, you come to class and you're like, oh man, you know. But if it's a nice day, on the other hand, you're like, oh cool, good weather, summer. Anyway, maybe that works for you, maybe it doesn't. But anyway, compounds are that way. And again, going back to this idea of these microstates, these things just have more energy to move around. All right, so they'll vibrate more and they'll rotate more. So the higher temperatures will always have higher entropy than the lower temperatures will. So this is just comparing this heptane molecule at these two extreme temperatures, a lot more entropy at the higher one. And you can see that these numbers are usually averages, like these up and downs right here. this is like an average entropy. There would be times when it'd be a little higher, a little less than.
In general, the more complex a molecule, the greater its entropy. We can see this trend by comparing three alkane molecules. The amount of motion for each molecule translates into entropy. The more motion overall, the greater the entropy.
So this goes back to the idea again of these little microstates, and the only important thing you need to realize is that as you get more and more atoms, or even bigger molar masses with one atom, you're going to have more entropy. These are the three simple alkanes, methane, ethane, and propane, and these are the values of the entropy, and you can see the numbers are increasing. Methane has one carbon, so it has those hydrogens running around it. But of course, this one has two carbons with extra atoms, and this has even more carbons and hydrogens. So the more pieces you get, the bigger the entropy. Noble gases are also that way. These are all single atoms now, but their molar masses are getting bigger. So we draw them as little spheres, but you have to realize that inside, there are electron clouds and stuff like that. So the theory is that larger molar masses have more like electrons sometimes on this side than that side. It's a type of a motion, but it's on the electron scales now. Punchline again, molar mass increases, the entropy also increases. Questions on any of this stuff?
The entropy of a solid depends on the strength of the forces holding it together. The weaker the attractive forces, the greater the motion of the ions in the crystal lattice, and the greater the entropy.
This one right here is comparing two ionic compounds. Now, sodium and magnesium are very close in molar mass. Oxygen and fluorine are very close in molar mass. But you can see there's quite a bit of a difference here between the two compounds. And the rationale for that, again, is you've got this single handshake, double handshake. Melissa, may I bother you? Thank you. Single handshake, sodium fluoride, single one, all right. But I haven't seen Melissa forever. Oh, Melissa, it's so good to see you. Thank you, Melissa. Daria, it would be harder for Daria to say, come on, guys, stop it. Oh, it takes Daria extra energy, thank you, Melissa, for breaking up the double handshake than the single handshake. Again, really dorky, thank you, Melissa. But that's what's going on here. Magnesium oxide, double handshake. Entropy can't do its microstates as well because it's a stronger bond. All right, single handshake is totally strong, but there's more flexibility. All right, like Melissa was really shaking my hand there. That's a good handshake, by the way. Anyway, there was more movement right there. With a double handshake, though, it's more movement, less constraint. So as positive negatives increases, or Coulombic laws, if you want to go back to Chem 221, the entropy actually does go down on those. It's a little stronger. Question.
When potassium permanganate dissolves, its crystal lattice is broken apart, leading to an increase in disorder, and therefore an increase in entropy.
This is an example of making an ionic compound, and this isn't across the board, but it's a generalization. If you take a pure solid and pure water and you mix it together, you're increasing the disorder, the randomness of the things. So almost always, solutions have higher entropy than the stuff they come from, all right? This isn't always the case. There are exceptions here, but more often than not, making a solution will increase your entropy, all right? And again, the rationale is that having sodium chloride separate, very pure, very cool compound, having water as itself, and then mixing the two, now you have like a messy room situation, all right? The sodium chloride hydrated ions are all over the place. It's harder to have predictability, more randomness. So which of these would be an increase in entropy? Now, remembering the things that we've done so far, all right, if you go from solid to liquid and liquid to gas, those are ways to increase the entropy. Is freezing water going from a solid to a liquid or a liquid to a solid?
Liquid to solid.
This one is probably not going to be an increase in entropy. We would be decreasing it, actually. However, boiling water, are you going from a liquid to a gas or a gas to a liquid? That's right, you're going from a liquid to a gas when you boil. That should give you an increase in the entropy. Now, this next one, crystallizing a salt, you have a solution and you're essentially pulling the solid out of it. Your new solid has those good old Coulombic kind of FCC, BCC, SC kind of unit cells going on. Those are very organized systems. That would be an increase in entropy. And here, it's harder to see, but you have 2 moles of gas going to 1 mole of gas, all right? This has more messiness, more pieces running around. This is a single molecule. So while the N's to NO's can be running around all the place, the N2O2's is more compact. This would also be a decrease in entropy. If you have an overall lowering of moles and everything is the same phase, this would actually be a decrease in entropy as well. You're forcing all those individual pieces to become more constant and stuff. So, any questions on that? So there's going to be tables of values of entropy, and when you get to this section, there's one in your textbook that you can absolutely use. There's one that's on our website. The value in our textbook is like 20 pages long, so I didn't put it with your problem set. I apologize, it's too much paper. But any way you want to find it is fine. If we just look at these different values, first of all, notice that they're all positive. None of them are zero or negative. Zero is possible if you're at zero Kelvin, which is like never. Negative doesn't happen for individual pieces. Here is CO versus CO2. You're adding an oxygen, and notice that the entropy increases, all right? The extra oxygen will create more entropy. Here's an example of a liquid going to a gas for water. You can tell again that the gas has more entropy than the liquid does, etc., etc. So it's kind of cool. Here's another example, positive 1, negative 1 versus positive 2, negative 2. So here's Melissa and I with a single handshake. Here's Melissa and I with a double handshake. She's holding on really strong right here. Not as much chance for those microstate entropy things to kick in. But here it's positive. Positive one, negative one. So in Chem 221 and a little bit in Chem 222, we looked at a couple different ways to talk about enthalpy. And these enthalpy things we will use in this section, all right? And we'll also take the corresponding versions and apply them to entropy. So we're having a little bit of a flashback here, and I don't think it'll be like, you know, PTSD flashbacks, but as always, if you're looking at this thing, you're like, oh, I don't remember, man, reach out to me, give me a second, and I will get you back up to speed. Now, the one thing we did, I think this was, chapter 5 in Chem 221, but I don't remember. I get my textbooks mixed up. Anyway, Q equals MC delta T was something we did a lot with. And Q, which was essentially Q at constant pressure equals delta H. This was really great if you had a temperature change, but no change in phase. So if we took some water at, say, 30 degrees Celsius, and we heated it to to 70 degrees Celsius, we wouldn't change the phase. It would still be liquid water. We would have a delta T. In this section, we talked about the heat capacity of water, 4.184. And I do want you to know / memorize that. We'll use it again in this section. It's a constant for liquid water, and it works really well for a lot of different things as well. So if you know the mass of the substance, heat capacity, 4.184 is the only one you need to know, all the other ones I give you, times the delta T, which was final minus initial temperature, you can calculate the enthalpy. It was given the symbol Q, which in the thermodynamic world is kind of special. Just realize that because almost everything we do is at constant pressure, delta H and Q for us is the same. But what happens when you melt the ice or when you boil the water? And that's when you get into a phase change. Now, phase changes don't have any delta T associated with them. This particular type of delta H is for the place where the substance changes from a liquid to a gas, excuse me, from a solid to a liquid. And all of these look like something like a mass of something times a heat of something. And it's very vague. The mass is usually in grams or moles, and the heat is going to be something like a heat of fusion, a heat of vaporization. As an example of this, the heat of fusion, which is where a solid goes to a liquid, for water is 333 joules per gram. What temperature does water go from a solid to a liquid? Zero Celsius, that's right, good. It's important to remember these things. You say 32 and I won't kick you out, but you start using Celsius, young man or woman. Yeah, I like your answer, by the way. Zero Celsius is what I was looking for, all right? Zero Celsius is where the water as a solid goes to a liquid. So at zero Celsius, this heat of fusion thing would kick in. Now, heat of vaporization is when liquid water goes to gaseous water. At what temperature does that occur? 100 Celsius, right on. Use 212. Oh, you're getting on my nerves, but it's okay. 100 Celsius is the answer I would like, but 212 is okay too. But anyway, that's the place where it boils, all right? And at where it boils, 40.7 kilojoules per mole is a number that's sometimes thrown around. So the reason this mass is in quotes right here, sometimes these crazy heat things are in grams, and sometimes they're in moles. So you just need to compensate for which one is which. You do not have to memorize fusion heats or vaporization heats. Just know how to use them and stuff. Any questions on that? We looked at things like this where we actually calculated the overall heat of going from ice, say, at negative 50 to steam at 100. Anytime you have a change of temperature, that's when you use the MC delta T parts right here. This would be where you'd use the heat of fusion, vaporization, excuse me. You're going from a liquid to a gas at this point. This would be where you'd use that heat of fusion, going from the solid to the liquid. All right. Now, entropy has its own version of these things, and that's why I'm kind of introducing it. So if you have a temperature change instead of the MC delta T, which we use for enthalpy, entropy is NC natural log T2 over T1. All right? So you can probably think where some of these things come from. N is the symbol, as you know, for moles. So in this case, we're going to use the moles of substances. And C is the molar heat capacity. So instead of having a heat capacity in grams, you could turn it into moles. And that would be something I would give you. And then T2 and T1 are Kelvin temperatures. So as an example, I'm sure you're just dying to know what the entropy change is for taking half a mole of water, roughly, from 281 Kelvin to 294 Kelvin. Well, no problem. First of all, you need to convert your heat capacity to a molar heat capacity. 4.184 is joules per gram Kelvin. If you multiply by 18 grams per mole, the grams in the bottom and the grams on the top cancel, you get this number, which is the molar heat capacity. You can put that in for C, 0.499 moles, T2 over T1. Entropy, 1.70 joules per Kelvin. I'm sure you're thrilled. these numbers are usually represented as joules per Kelvin. We'll see why in a little bit. It also goes to show the fact that entropy is very temperature dependent. So if you started to change the temperature on this even more, you'd start to see weird things. If you have a phase change, S equals Q over T, where Q is the heat transfer. So this is analogous now to the heat of quote-unquote times the heat, quote unquote, of something that we talked about for delta H. The good news about this is that the Q is basically the Q that we would have done for enthalpy. So, for water as a liquid going to water as a gas, the Q value is 40,700 joules per mole. This is something you can calculate, and we'll talk about how we did that later.
When liquid water converts to the vapor state, its molecules disperse over a greater region of space. This represents an increase in entropy.
So if you take the value of delta H, that's what the Q is, and you divide it by the temperature, that's how you find the entropy at these different things. So if you have a phase change, this is one way that you can calculate the entropy of it instead of just the enthalpy of a phase change. So here's an example of what you can do here. This is an example. We want to find the entropy change for the vaporization of xenon. So that means we're turning the liquid into a gas. The temperature at which this happens is this temperature right here. And we're given delta H of vaporization in this number. Now, at first, this looks really intimidating, but let's just break it down. It's Q, or delta H, divided by temperature. And this thing right here, that's our Q, all right? So we want to divide it by the temperature. Do you think we're going to use Celsius or Kelvin? Kelvin, that's right. So mathematically, what you do is you take the delta H, you divide it by the Kelvin temperature. This is the number that pops up. So sometimes these can look intimidating, but they're not too bad. Now, the good news is that we won't do a lot of entropy changes with temperature and entropy changes with phases. But if you have to in a future course, you now have seen, been exposed to it, it's not hard to do like all this stuff. You just gotta figure it out. Here's a graph, kind of like what we saw earlier for the enthalpy change. This is now an entropy part. So the entropy will get increased as the temperature goes up. Then you go through an entropy change as you melt the solid. That's the delta H over T we saw just a second ago. Then there's another part right here. And again, these parts are the NC natural log T2 over T1. Then you actually evaporate the liquid, so it's another big entropy change, and there you go. So this is, there's some similarities between enthalpy, but there are a few that are a little different. So this last section, I'm throwing in just to introduce it to you, but you're not going to see a lot of it. But what we will use a lot of in this class is this equation right here. And if you have a reaction and you want to find the overall entropy for it, it's the sum of all the entropies that are products minus the sum of all the entropies that are reactants. We did some of this stuff for enthalpy in Chem 221. We used tables of delta H values, products minus reactants for their delta H. This is the same kind of thing now, only now we're doing it for entropy. So if you wanted to figure out the entropy change for hydrogen gas and oxygen gas going to liquid water, you would take the products, 2 times the liquid water, minus the reactants, hydrogen and oxygen. And you would literally look these values up in a table of entropy, like the one we saw before or the one we'll use next week. If you do that, the water is a liquid, 69.9. Hydrogen, 130.7. Oxygen, 205. This is a plug and chug in your calculator. Delta S, negative 326.9. Now, notice that a change in entropy can be negative. Individual values of entropy are never negative. So like this one, and this one, those are all positive numbers, and that's the way they should be. but a change in entropy can be negative. And this is like what I said earlier. Like most reactions become more disordered, more messy. That would give you a delta S, which is positive. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, you're going to see a reaction become more ordered. Everything becomes more structured. And that's what we're seeing right here. Do gases or liquids have higher entropy? Gases, that's right. We are going from gases to liquids, all right? More disorder, less disorder. Entropy doesn't like this kind of reaction, all right? It wants to have more gases, more diffused kind of things. Nothing is concentrated. Also notice, we're going from 2 + 1, 3 moles on the reactant side to 2 moles on the product side. So you're going from lots of pieces to fewer pieces. Entropy hates this reaction. That's why it gets the negative symbol, all right? This reaction is like cleaning your room, all right? It's not going to be something that happens by itself. Entropy would rather turn the liquid water into the gaseous hydrogen and oxygen. What do you think the value of delta S would be for that reaction? Heard it? It's okay, positive. It'll be the opposite of the negative 326.9. The opposite reaction, which would be liquid water turning into hydrogen and oxygen, the delta S would be a positive 326.9. Remember in this thermodynamic stuff, a lot of times what's positive in one direction will be negative in the opposite direction. So if we just reverse reactants and products, our delta S becomes a positive. So I put this one up here to show that water is not likely to form from hydrogen and oxygen if you think about just entropy. All right? Entropy says, I don't like this reaction. But thankfully, Daphne still has a full thing of water, and so does Vadim. So we are not running out of water. There obviously is something else competing with entropy to make the liquid water form. And we'll see a little bit later that's going to be enthalpy. Here's another example. Making copper two oxide, CuO. Here are the individual entropy values. Figure out what the entropy of the reaction would be. And the punchline, products minus reactants. You would take this number, 42.59, and you would subtract this number, the copper, as well as 1/2 of the oxygen. Remember that you multiply these numbers by the stoichiometric coefficients out there. If you had to guess for this reaction, do you think that the answer is likely to be positive or negative? Negative. Good. If you think about it in terms of entropy, all right, going from a gas to a solid, lots of entropy, not a lot of entropy. So I would make a guess on this one that the entropy answer would be negative. If we were making a gas from a solid, we would say entropy would be positive. And so if you do the math, it does come out to be a negative 93.12. Again, entropy likes making gases from solids. It does not like making solids from gases. That's one way to kind of predict to see if your answer makes sense or not. So. The next slide, huge. Whoopee-doo! Second law of thermodynamics. I know you're excited, just like I am. All right. Second law of thermodynamics is incredibly powerful. A reaction is spontaneous, product favored, if the entropy of the universe is positive. What this looks like mathematically, the entropy of the universe equals the entropy of the system plus the entropy of the surroundings. And you have to have an entropy of the universe greater than zero for all product-favored irreversible processes. So if you want to know if a reaction is going to occur or not, figure out the entropy of the system, add it to the entropy of the surroundings. If your delta S of the universe is positive, the reaction will occur. But if the entropy of the universe is negative, not gonna happen.
My marriage, I told you, was dead for years. I don't know why.
Oh, yes, I do.
It's the second law of thermodynamics. Sooner or later, everything turns to shit. That's my phrasing, not the Encyclopedia Britannica.
So, again, I apologize for the bad word there. She said that basically, thermodynamics, second law of thermodynamics, everything turns to S. Mm-hmm. All right. Anyway, gotta keep it G-rated, kids, which obviously I'm failing. I'm going PG at this point. But anyway, this movie that's from Husbands and Wives, a really weird Woody Allen movie. But anyway, what she said there was that basically everything, after a while, goes to S. It goes to garbage. So entropy is all about disorder, messiness, all right? The world does not become more ordered. The world becomes more disordered, all right? So we end up not with concentrated sources of donuts and water and caffeine, whatever, all right? We end up with this big kind of messy amalgam of things. But what I want you to realize here, as we're almost out of time, is that this is what really all of physical science is about. If you have any reaction which happens, you must have a delta S of the universe is greater than zero. And that means, my friends, that you will not be making the world more ordered. It's going to become more disordered. So your fuel sources will be turned into carbon dioxide and water. Your sugar sources will be distributed as who knows what. But all of these things that we take for granted then are going to become less usable. Entropy is what's dictating all of this. Now, we're going to do more with what this refers to and where enthalpy fits in on Friday. Have a wonderful day, guys. See you soon.